The Unconventional Therapist's Guide to Nothing.
Hey everybody, welcome to The Unconventional Therapist. This is Dave. I'm here with my co-host Greg. And yeah, we're having a good little day. We're just chit-chatting before we start recording. Greg, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
That's nice.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot to say. This was a bigger topic than I thought it was going to be.
Greg, I had a thought today and I want to share it.
Okay.
So I was shown a video of Taylor Swift today.
Okay.
As one usually is, you know? Mm-hmm. And she had a young girl in the front of her audience, and she, I guess she gets to pick a person for a concert, and she'll usually do like a nice gesture, putting them in the front. And this girl was like part of a Make-A-Wish thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the young girl has a terminal illness, and Taylor, like, you know, has her in the front, gives her hat, and, you know, hugs her and says, "I love you." And then, you know, the little girl has her moment, which is super special. It's an amazing gesture, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like it made me like for a second think like, damn, I wish I could have that opportunity to do something like that. And I was like thinking like, oh, what if I got involved in this organization and that organization? Because that's like what I'll do. If I see something and it like will spawn like some kind of like inspiration, I'll be like, oh, how could I have a moment like that where I could make that kind of gesture to someone, right? Do you ever get that feeling?
No.
Oh, okay.
Is that weird?
Maybe.
Yeah, no, I want... my whole life is about trying to make people's lives a little bit better, but...
Oh, boy.
I just don't think that anybody...
Here we go.
...really cares.
St. Greg over here.
Yeah.
St. Greg, always making everyone's days better.
Father Teresa.
Totally stole the thunder from what I was going to say. Well, what I had a like that quick thought, which I often have thoughts like that. Like, I wish I could have the opportunity to have a moment or like be that important that I could make an impact on someone just by giving them my hat. Like, they would be like, oh my goodness, I'm in my life. Like, that'd be awesome. But no. But then I was like instantly started to think about like, we all have the ability to make impacts on people's lives on a daily basis. Through our work, through just who we are. But like, if I really wanted to think about it in a certain way, someone as simple as like, someone who works at like Dunkin' Donuts could have that ability to make someone's day or to make someone's day brighter, right? I thought that I was like thinking about this guy that works at Dunkin' around the corner, and he's always the happiest guy. And like in the morning, it'll be like early morning, and he'll be like, "Hey, my guy, have a great day. Awesome to see you." And I'm like, and just I leave there feeling good, right? Like, we all have that ability to have moments like that and brighten. So like I feel for a second I was like, oh, I'll never be able to have a moment where I can be that impactful. But then it's like, why do we need to have these grand gestures when we can like on a daily basis just make that our purpose, right?
Yo, and what a way to kind of, you know, we're all looking for meaning in life. Yeah. And if your meaning and part of your purpose can be making other people's lives a little bit better, and you're right, you really can shift someone's mood, but just by kind of, you know, treating them a little extra special, you know, when you see someone for the first time in the day, like that's purposeful. Like, you have to try to do that, and that benefits everybody.
Absolutely. And in that moment when I was having that thought, I was like, well, oh yeah, you know, we already kind of are in the field where we're constantly trying to, you know, help people make their lives a little brighter, help them through hard times. But I'm like thinking like even most jobs allow you the opportunity to have a moment like that. So if you're ever sitting there watching somebody like a celebrity, not to like, you know, knock down or minimize that gesture that was made, because that was a really special moment. And that's kind of inspired me to even have the thought in the first place. Like, you don't have to be a celebrity to be able to have that impact on other people. Most people in most positions can in one way, shape, or another. Even if it's to a coworker, if you don't have that ability to do it to, you know, a customer or another person, a patient, whatever.
Also, like, you know, you're saying that, and I'm thinking about us and our work, and sometimes, like, you don't know what's going on in people's lives. And that could just be the difference between them really kind of going off the rails that day and turning them around. Yeah. Really, like, I mean, sometimes I know even for myself, like we're both working a lot and we're really sometimes, you know, burning the candle on both ends, and just someone kind of like going the extra mile for you, or just, and all that is kind of like a gesture of kindness. I mean, that really does go a long way. And what a nice way to start the podcast.
Yeah.
Albeit completely out of context, but I
totally out
of
context, but it was a thought I had like just literally a few hours ago. And if that Dunkin' Donuts dude that works up the road from me is listening, which he probably isn't, but who knows? Thank you for, you know, every once in a while that I go to Dunkin', you brighten up my day, dude.
Yeah, and do
you're
that.
Just a genuine guy, and I can tell.
It's like that movie with I See Dead People, but it's not I See Dead People, where he does something nice for people every once in a while.
I see this guy as a dead soul. Yes. You see me.
Okay.
All right. So, Greg, I know you're chomping at the bit to get into the topic. Go ahead.
All right. So, listen. Thank you, Dave. I appreciate that. So, and I do appreciate that sentiment. I really do. And I think that is a nice way to start off the podcast. I'm going to kind of go a different way right now for a little bit. And I'm going to talk about the Renaissance here for a second. And when I think of the Renaissance, I think of Shakespeare and Da Vinci and other forms of high art and cultural understanding and the importance of the origin and where this stuff came from. It's sort of a look into what a culture should be. But to me, that has always been sort of a recycling more than a rebirth. Renaissance means rebirth, right? So Shakespeare was incredible. I've actually been reading a little bit of Shakespeare lately. And
yes.
Unbelievable flowery language, but very unoriginal. He didn't write these scripts. He took this from, like, Othello was a news story. Romeo and Juliet had already been written. Julius Caesar was a historical situation, right? So these things are sort of recycled. And to me, a rebirth is something that's more fitting with the Renaissance that we're going to be talking about, maybe even a truer Renaissance. What we're going to be talking about today is the Harlem Renaissance. This is like the American Athens, so to speak.
I love that you're bringing up Shakespeare and the Harlem Renaissance within the same conversation. If you met me in my undergrad college years, this would have been the exact two things I would have been talking to you about, because I was big into Shakespeare and I was big into the Harlem Renaissance and African American literature at the time. Those were like my two favorite courses. And that's kind of what inspired me to suggest this episode, it being Black History Month and everything. We always try to tie in some sort of movement or event that occurred. And this one was really special to me. And I actually want to shout out my professor, Dr. Scott, over at Rhode Island College, who unfortunately passed away, I believe, last year. But he was the one who really introduced me to this literature movement. And it really, really inspired me. And I got pretty into it. And he was a great professor. Really tragic. He was rather young when he passed. But this was, this was really inspiring to me.
So, Dave, I think that, like, maybe the audience could look forward to a future Shakespeare episode.
Oh, 100%. 100%.
I had no idea. Like, I'm actually a little bit of a Shakespeare fan myself, and I had no idea that you were kind of into that. There's a lot of themes that we can get into when it comes to Shakespeare. But for now, let's talk about the Harlem Renaissance and what it is exactly to me. And I think probably it sounds like to you, it's a movement, a consciousness of Black Americans who, for some, are only one generation removed from slavery. This is happening to me, which is incredible, during Jim Crow, lynching, the KKK are at peak powers.
Yes.
And this is wild. Like, so in the face of this comes the re-identification, and I use that word very purposefully, identification of Black culture. It's the epitome of the phrase that we've used so many times here. Not why me, but what now, right? This is the first generation of free Black Americans. And with freedom comes this, you have to develop an identity.
Isn't the term movement, to have a movement, isn't that the epitome of that phrase you just said? Not why me, but what now? A movement. 100%. Yeah. Yeah. And that's what this is.
And it's almost like you don't want to put it in with other movements because it makes it feel a little bit less than. Like you don't want to say it's, you don't want to put it with like the hippies, right? Kind of. Because even though that's a movement, this feels, granted, art and I'm sure literature and things came from that movement too. But this is something so much more powerful. Just the collection of artists and thinkers that are powerful enough to have this international following. This was even going on in Paris and across the Atlantic, yes. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's titled the Harlem Renaissance, but in many ways, this is not just in Harlem. Like this was being influenced in Detroit, Chicago, you know, like you said, Paris, I believe. There's other countries that were influenced by this movement. So this was
everywhere cool.
Yeah, it was a worldwide thing, but it very much was happening in Harlem. That was like kind of the epicenter, right?
Yeah.
So this took place from what years, Greg?
Well, I guess it's kind of up for debate, but towards the end of World War One, so you're talking 1918 probably to just about 1930.
Mid-30s. It starts to peter off towards the around 1937, actually, I believe. So, yeah, this is really it's considered like the golden age in African-American culture because it's manifesting in literature, music, stage performances, art, just anything that you would consider to be like culture, right? Like cultural. And it's a really important and unusual movement for the time because it's mixing like literature and artistic movements along with civil rights and reform organizations. So we have like these civil rights organizations actually like supporting and backing up like literature or, you know, right. Performance arts, which is kind of strange. But that's all happening during this time.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely. And I had never thought of it in terms of civil rights, but I guess you have to, like, this is the beginning of, this is the real beginning of civil rights. Like, this is, you know, people like Du Bois were, and, you know, Larson, you could name Hughes, all these people, Martin Luther King were standing on the shoulders of these people. These are the people that got things started. So should we kind of talk about how this thing starts? Like, what's the origin of this date?
Yeah. Well, Harlem prior to this movement, it's in originally, if you want to go way back, it was inhabited by Native Americans, a Native tribe.
That's going way back. That's going maybe a little too far back.
They were called the Manhattans. But I think it's interesting to point that out because it also kind of shows like it's, you know, we think about, who ends up inhabiting it, but like there's like this conflict that's already existed prior. So the Native tribe originally there, maybe some other tribes as well. Dutch settlers come around 1637. There's conflict with the Native Americans, which causes their population to decrease, and then then we have like the white inhabitants. Flash forward really quick to the 1800s. In around the 1880s, Harlem was intended to be like this upper class white neighborhood. What they end up doing is they overdevelop it too rapidly, and that leads to a bunch of empty buildings and really desperate landlords. So in the early 1900s, you get a few like middle class black families from that eventually kind of moving in. Initially, there's some white residents that are trying to fight to keep off the black families, but they're not successful. So many of them flee. From 1910 to 1920, African-American populations start to migrate in like very large numbers from the South to the North. And that's because of what we now know as the Great Migration. Greg, do you want to describe what the Great Migration is?
Well, all right. So I didn't know that we were going from Miles Standish to Miles Davis with the history, but yeah. I appreciate that. But yeah, the Great Migration, obviously something that comes after the Civil War. It's, you know, there's freedom for the African Americans in the South. But like, think about it like this. So you're down south, and maybe you can make 75 cents a day doing whatever job you're doing. You could go up north and work in a factory and maybe make $3 or $4 a day. But maybe the conditions won't be great either way.
Yeah.
Right? But you're literally making 10 times your salary. And are you going to be treated better? Yes. Is there less resentment about their freedom because of the outcome of the war? 100%. So there's more opportunity. And I think most importantly, for the people in the South, this is an opportunity for a completely new identity, an opportunity to come out from underneath this, you know, slavery, this history of slavery, and become something that you never could have been.
I don't think that's realized until they're there, though. Like, I don't think that's part of like the reason they go. I think it is, like you said, definitely the economic opportunities. Segregation laws are super harsh in the South. They start to, the other big thing is from like 1915 to 1916, there's these natural disasters in the South that put Black workers and sharecroppers out of work. So, you know, they're coming up again for job opportunities, stuff like that. And then the other thing is during and after World War I, Northern recruiters headed to the South to entice Black workers to their companies. So they were looking for employees, and, you know, so they were actually like recruiting them up. So basically around like around 1920, there's around 300,000 African Americans from the South that have moved North. And Harlem was one of the most popular of those destinations. Harlem, I didn't realize how small it was. It's only like 3 square miles. Mm-hmm. And it was said to have 175,000 African Americans alone, making it the largest concentration of Black people in the world at that time.
Yeah.
That's insane.
And don't forget, like, this is happening at the same time as Tulsa's developing right now, too, right? Black Wall Street's developing. This isn't just happening in New York. This is happening. There's parallels all over the country. This is just where it's all going, like the epicenter, like you said before.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that you brought up sharecropping. Like, there's all these institutions in the South that are just designed to keep African Americans down. Like, sharecropping is like the original payday loan. Like, you can work and you're never going to be able to own any land or pay for anything. You're just always going to be in debt. It's just saying, like, it's this existential moment in history where people are saying, I'm not doing this anymore. There's something bigger out there for me. Like, this is over and I'm going to become something else, and I can't do it here.
Yeah.
So it's almost like it's like an alchemist story in a way. It's
right.
You know, searching for something.
So we have this huge population rising up north around Harlem and all and surrounding areas. Around this time, there's also like this dramatic increase in literacy rates, which will, you know, impact some of this movement for obvious reasons. And then there's also these national organizations such as the NAACP, which are emerging to, just support African-American civil rights. So you got the political stuff going on. You got literacy rates increasing and people becoming more like having more access, I guess, to the arts. That's a big piece for this. So no, starts to like culminate.
Something that people and we're gonna get into music and everything like that. And researching this, you have to conclude that musically, there isn't American music without African American people. There just isn't. It just would never exist. But even more astonishing than that is, you just mentioned the literacy rates. So literacy is brand new, because when you're a slave owner, you want to keep people away from knowledge. You want to keep family away. You want to do all these things. Like, knowledge is bad. So this is a brand new thing, like the literacy. And so you're new to reading and writing, and you're producing incredible high art. I mean, like literature, stuff that's still being read to this day. Now that is something that's incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. Greg, there's this term, before we get into the art stuff, there's this term called Pan-Africanism. And I think that this is a really important concept when we're talking about the Harlem Renaissance for people to understand truly what this movement was about. So there's two major players, but the concept of Pan-Africanism is the idea that peoples of Africa, African descent, have common interests and should be unified mm-hmm. on those concepts. So the two major players in that are W.E.B. Du Bois and Marcus Garvey. So could you kind of describe, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois' role in this, and I'll talk about Marcus Garvey.
Yeah, I've had a small interest in Du Bois for a little while. Like there was a book on display when I was undergrad at PC, and it was just said Du Bois, and I was like, what is that about? And I kind of got into it a little bit. And it was this incredible civil rights leader who sadly passed away a year shy of seeing the act pass, the Civil Rights Act in 1964. And just months before the Kennedy assassination, he also missed the Beatles. Coming to America, which, you know, for me, that's a big deal. One of the founders of the NAACP, which is something that's still in functioning today and a hugely powerful force in, so, you know, social justice today in America. He was all about fighting against Jim Crow laws, lynching and discrimination. And not just saying that what you have to remember is he's fighting against this stuff. This stuff is happening right, like in his face, and it's happening with the consent of the government. So him speaking out about this would give him the intention of the FBI, like the FBI would be looking into him. And the FBI looked into Dr. King, but it was sort of subliminal and like no one really kind of knew about it. It was this private thing. But it was the role of the government at this point was like, this guy's dangerous. Right? I mean, of course they had like socialist tendencies and communist tendencies, just like some of the other figures in this. But I mean, if you were all you want is equality, I mean, you have to kind of, you're going to lean towards that kind of thing anyways. Mm-hmm. They're just looking for equality here. But like I said earlier, it just shows that these civil rights leaders that we know today were really have to thank these, the pioneers who really kind of put their necks on the line to make this kind of thing possible, right?
Yeah.
And there's a couple of quotes here from him that I think are pretty great. But before I even say that, he was the kind of person that was all, like a lot of his quotes were all about, like, let's not cry about it. Let's kind of do something about it right now. It's all like, don't talk so much. Let's kind of get out there and do this thing. One of his great quotes is, the cost of liberty is less than the price of oppression. So this is the kind of person who's willing to, you know, put himself out there, not just talk about it, but be about it, right?
Yeah.
He also says, there in this world is no such force as a person determined to rise. The soul cannot be permanently chained. So powerful, one generation removed from slavery.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like, it's true. You've tried to chain this culture, you tried to repress this culture for so long, and it just permeates through in the most incredible way. Just like, it's almost like you push so hard against it that it just explodes back in the early 20th century.
So,
and that's
he would probably align best with Martin Luther King as far as like his view of how things should go. Like he believed in, like you said, kind of acting. Mm-hmm. And not just accepting and not just complaining, but he did believe in integration versus segregation, which I think is really important to recognize. One of the people he opposes in, you know, this Civil Rights Act is Marcus Garvey, who was another big player in this Pan-Africanism. They just had very different views. But even Booker T. Washington had urged African-Americans to accept discrimination for the time being and elevate themselves through hard work and economic gain to win the respect of the whites. Whereas Du Bois argued that strategy would act, rather than freeing them from oppression, would only serve to perpetuate it. Like essentially, if we just sit here and accept it, it's never going to change. Why would it change? They're never going to
respect
us.
It's like saying like, by seeking approval, it's like lowering yourself. And what Du Bois wanted to be was on the level playing field. It's like a meritocracy, the same kind of like meritocracy that, you know, the content of our character, that's Dr. King. That's what the same thing that Du Bois is looking for.
Yeah, they, to me, seem like very much on similar playing fields when it comes to their perspective of, you know, how we should be fighting against discrimination.
I just think maybe it's a generation thing, but it feels like Du Bois in his writing is a little more rough around the edges. And Dr. King was just one of the most eloquent like writers and speech, right? I mean, his speeches were incredible. So, I mean, everyone, like different strengths there.
What one of Dubois' books, Souls of Black Folk from 1903, actually was one of the books that had a really profound impact on what formed the core of the Harlem Renaissance. So he's a major contributor to the whole movement. So the other person to mention, you know, as far as this Pan-Africanism and what's, you know, kind of leading up to the Harlem Renaissance is Marcus Garvey. He was always someone I found super interesting. He's this Black nationalist from Jamaica who moved to Harlem in 1916. But he's just very outspoken and like kind of flamboyant and just interesting. But he believes he's actually pro segregation. He believes they're in equality, but there can be separate equalities. So he's like kind of fine. He actually, one of the shocking things I found was he even approved of the Ku Klux Klan because it sought to separate races. That brought him a lot of enemies, obviously. So this, that's a really interesting approach to take because, you know, kind of thinking about other civil right movement activists that we know. But this was kind of his take. So he started the newspaper, The Negro World, which told of exploits of heroes of the race and the splendors of African culture. So he was big on just really emphasizing that the African culture is beautiful and that like there's so much to it and there's like so much power within it. And he really wanted to, you know, people to embrace that. So he, you know, preached for there to be an independent Black economy. And he even started his own shipping line called Black Star Line, which had trade between Africans in America, the Caribbean, South and Central America, Canada and Africa. Eventually this all, you know, it didn't work out in his favor. He was
that's
famously
actually hysterical though, because it's like the White Star Line is ran the Titanic. That's like the Titanic is one of the ships of that company. That's incredible.
Well, this kind of plummeted too, I guess. and he was at odds with Dubois, who actually called him the most dangerous enemy of the Negro in America. And he became also a target of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI because of how outspoken he was. He unfortunately was in his members of the Universal Negro Movement Association, which he had started. They were indicted for mail fraud in 1922, and he was eventually deported, I believe. So that definitely, you know, kind of slowed down his movement. So, and
it is interesting, but like but not as crazy as it sounds, because if you think about how powerful a Black economy could have been, especially if you think about it now, right? Like with the music and the literature and what was going on in Tulsa with Black Wall Street. I mean, thriving economies that would have, who knows what the top would have been if not, you know, undercut by racism, right?
Right. It feels like
complicated.
During that time, maybe that framework made sense.
Yeah.
But it feels inevitable that at some point there's going to be like a competitive nature or there's going to be this desire to for one to be better than the other and to utilize their power to make sure that one is always beneath the other. Like having two equal economies feels like that's probably not feasible.
Right.
It's the idea that communism can never actually exist in its purest form, right? We've had that conversation. Yeah. There's always going to be some level of like hierarchy or, you know, because that's just what man does. I guess. I don't know. That's just my opinion.
I have to agree with you. I don't think it could work either. I mean, because obviously, like, we've learned that in our own lives and, you know, throughout history, like, there's strength in diversity. I mean, that's just the way it is. Look at it. I mean, that's one of the great things about America. I know there's a lot of complaints about America, but like the reason why we're always showing up at the like one of the best in the Olympics because it's strength in diversity. I mean, that's just the way it is.
One of the big things that he used to also say, Marcus Garvey, before I move on from him, is he used to say, if we can't achieve equality here, then we should go back to Africa. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that is something that I would assume probably resonated with some people. Like, why should we continue to stay here where we're not wanted, where we're not treated equally, when we can just go back to our roots and, you know, be treated equally? Why do we constantly fight? I wonder how. Yeah, it would be interesting to know, like, if that was something that a lot of people connected with at the time. I'm assuming there was, because he was obviously a rather big figure, but definitely had some opposition.
But I think, like, part of what America, what makes America strong in its own way, is that we're, and it's not, I don't know if it's a necessarily good thing, but it's like we're all kind of sort of fighting to make it our own. So yeah. It's like this, they're always kind of like at each other, and I don't know, and it takes like a threat from the outside to have us unify. Otherwise, we're just always kind of tearing at each other. Isn't that just kind of the way it's always been?
Yeah. I mean, look how we are today with anybody who's successful, tear them down. Tear them down. Yeah.
Like when you were saying about Taylor Swift, I was like, tear down.
I had to make sure I was like, you know, everyone's clear. I'm not tearing her down, because like, I don't want to get any hate for that. I know how beloved she is.
You don't want to mess with her right now.
No. So, Greg, are you familiar with Alan Locke?
I am not.
Writer, philosopher, a bunch of other great mm-hmm. titles. He's actually the person who coined the phrase, and this is his phrase, not mine, just to be clear, the Negro Renaissance. he coined that to help break stereotypes. I love this. This is what this movement is about. He coined it to help break stereotypes and sought to reconceptualize the African-American apart from the white stereotypes that had influenced Black people's relationships to their heritage and to each other.
Yeah, so, that's. I think you're talking about like a Pygmalion effect there, where like your ideas of somebody that people are telling you like what you are for so long.
Yeah.
That it's like almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
100%.
You start to act that way, right?
Yeah.
And so he's saying like, no, that's not who you are, which is scary to create a whole new identity. And I think that that's the crux of what this is about, is the creation. You're creating art, you're creating music, you're creating, you're creating identity more than anything.
Yes. Yep. So he was a Harvard educated writer who was considered the dean of the Harlem Renaissance. And actually, on March 19th, 1968, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. proclaimed, "We're going to have to let our children know that the only philosophers that lived were not Plato and Aristotle, sorry, Greg, but W.E.B. Dubois and Alan Locke came through the universe." So he was, you know, obviously a major supporter of Alan Locke and his, you know, his views. And he was just a major figure in coining this term, but also really setting the framework for what this is all about, which is exactly what you just said. It's about identity. It's about creating our own identity, but embracing our culture and our history and where we're from, and using
that. No, but it's interesting,
right?
Yeah, no, it's interesting that you say that. And that's why I call it like the American Athens sort of right now, mm-hmm. because it's interesting that you do mention Plato and Aristotle, because in the same way that they're saying, you know, 2000 years ago, who are we? That's what the philosophy is like. That's where it starts. That's why it's so powerful, because they're trying to answer these super simple questions like, who are we? What is justice to us? What is equality to us? What is freedom to us? That's exactly what people like W. Dubois and, as you say, Alan Locke, are saying in this time. Like, who are we? Who do we want to be? Like, what is, you know, what's the right path for us?
Yeah. So it's absolutely huge. And it's all framed on the idea of Black equality, no longer just adjusting or complying with unreasonable requests from, you know, from white people. But also having self-confidence and political awareness. So we're not just like blind to what's going on around us and like feeling like we are worthless or we have to just accept our situations, but we can create our situations. Very, very influential figure who I feel like is rarely ever spoken about, but has a lot to do with just everything that happens within the Harlem Renaissance and even just kind of like kickstarting it.
Never even heard of him.
Never even.
That's so pretty wild.
That is. I guess we can start off with the first like domain in within the Harlem Renaissance, which would be literature. And there, yeah. This is, I feel, Greg, do you agree with this? Like literature, I mean, there's obviously there's music, there's performing arts, there's visual arts. I feel like literature, though, is probably the biggest thing that comes out of the Harlem Renaissance. Aside from, like, music is obviously huge, too. But, like, the literature is really the framework of it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I know it's so hard to say, though, because it is kind of a between literature and music, for sure. Because in music, the music's pretty powerful, too. And the music has always been something that has, you know, before African Americans, the music in America was operas and English plays. So without their you know, touch for this, like there's no such thing as American music. There's no such thing as the artist today. I don't just mean the artist today by, you know, like hip hop and everything like that. I mean like, you know, soul and rock and roll and the Beatles and just the gospel music, yacht rock, all of it is influenced by, you know, gospel and
yeah.
So, the jazz. And
well, we always, you know, we're very familiar now with how Elvis was so inspired by African-American music and, you know, how obviously Elvis has inspired, you know, a ton of others. So like,
yeah.
If you trace it back to where it's from, it's, yeah, it's like the literature is the brain and the backbone. Mm-hmm. And the music is the style and the swag, right? It's like, it's just everything about the movement.
The like music is like the mood, right?
Yes. Yeah. When you think of the Harlem Renaissance, I really want people to think of like these, you know, these nightclubs where everybody's dressed up in like these really like flamboyant outfits and just like dancing the night away. And it's jazz and it's like illegal alcohol because of the prohibition. Yeah. And, you know, it's just this great time. But then there's these really big brains involved, and that's the literature piece. And yeah. they're really talking about the pain and the suffering, but also the potential, you know, light at the end that we can achieve and our strength, right?
100%. And for me, there happened to be a book that was in my consciousness before talking about this. And I didn't know that it was a part of this movement. And so Nella Larsen, I'm going to talk about her for a second. Her mother was white. So this is kind of interesting. This is really, I only bring up her upbringing because we're talking about identity here and we're talking about literature. And this is kind of coinciding in her. She's kind of the perfect figure for this. Her mother was white and her father was half black. So it's not until college that she's living within an African-American community. So this gave her this uncomfortable feeling of not belonging anywhere. She didn't belong to either the black or white communities. She ends up being a nurse. She's a librarian. And then she starts to get more interested in her African heritage. So she writes this book. Passing is the name of the book. And it's a huge recommend. Have you come across this, Dave? Have you read this book, Passing?
No.
Okay, so I have, and this is, it's an interesting sociological experiment, but it's fiction. It's filled with themes that we love in this podcast, like self-deception, identity. The book is about friends, two friends. They're both mixed race. And when they're young, they split up, and one ends up being raised by the white parent, ends up marrying a white man. That mm-hmm. white man is a racist. And the other friend identifies as black, grows up in a black community, right? So when they're older, when they're both adults, they reunite and they're completely fascinated with each other. And they take this interest in each other's life. So you can imagine the guilt and the conflict and in this book, the eventual tragedy. But imagine like coming from looking at the Harlem Renaissance from her perspective, where she couldn't see it from the white point of view and the black point of view. So it's this really interesting thing. So she can literally feel how a black person's being treated and see like and even treat black people a certain way at times, right?
Sure.
So she's like on both sides of the fence here. And it's like, who better to understand this conflict better?
I'm gonna make an assumption too. She's probably lighter skinned.
Yeah.
which within
passing. She could pass. It was like a little that was like a term you could pass.
Yeah. But even within this whole movement, and you know, at the time, that was a deal too. Like lighter skinned individuals had an easier time than darker skinned individuals. And that's actually a topic of writings in, you know, during this movement, and kind of people just being able to embrace, like, even though I'm, you know, a darker skinned African American, I still deserve the same rights that even, you know, my light skinned friend has in things like that. So, you know, her situation definitely is an interesting one.
Yeah, I was just fascinated by her. But go on. Now, who would you like to bring
up? So, yeah, there's poets, there's authors, but also a big thing at this time was like writers for like journals and short, like they would write like short pieces and things. And like journals were like everything at that time. I didn't like, it's kind of interesting to think about that. Like, where were they getting the journals? Is that just like, you know, you go to your grocery store, they have all those free magazines. Is that where the journals would be? Or do you have to like purchase them somewhere? It's interesting because that's a big part of this movement is like the National Association for the Advancement of Colored Peoples, the Crisis, the National Urban League's Opportunity. There's a number of these publications. So a lot of the authors and poets that we'll talk about also contributed to those. And that was a big thing in getting kind of their names out there and their works out there to the general public, it sounded like. Just some notable names before I go into a really like significant one. Claude McKay. Are you familiar with him at all?
No.
So he was a poet. Harlem Shadows in 1922 was a really a big one for him. In 1928, he published his first novel, Home to Harlem, which is said to be the most widely read novel written by an African American up to that time. And he wrote the poem If We Must Die in 1919, which is the most quoted works of an African American literature of this time period as well.
So I am familiar with that poem.
I read that as well. It's definitely, yeah, it's embracing like our destiny, right? Mm-hmm. It's saying basically we're not going to just accept, we're not just going to roll over, we're not going to just accept what's given to us.
Yeah, that's the crux.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Gene Toomer, who I was reading about him, his book Cain, which is from 1923, and then I was at the store the other day and I actually found it, so I grabbed that. Haven't dug into it yet. James Weldon Johnson, he was a civil rights activist. He's a notable name, just a number of them. Dora Neale Hurston's novel, The Eyes Are Watching God from 1937 is regarded to be one of like the signal achievements of the Harlem Renaissance. So that's like huge, huge, novel right there. One of the most notable names and the name you'll commonly hear when you're talking about the Harlem Renaissance is of course, Langston Hughes. He was born in Missouri in 1902, raised in Kansas by his grandma until he was 13, moved to Cleveland with his mom and her new boyfriend, and starts writing poetry while he's in high school. One of his most famous poems, which is called The Negro Speaks of Rivers, he wrote at 15 years old. So obviously this is, you know, a very intelligent man, very articulate, very intelligent. He's different than most of the Black writers at the time because of this. First, he addresses Black people directly. So he's writing for that audience. And he's using a language that he feels could be understood by anybody who reads it, making it relatable. And if you read any of his writings, it's, what would be the best way to describe it, Greg?
It's a lot of slang, right? Yeah, but there's something to that though, because that's happened before in the past, like Chaucer. The reason why we know Geoffrey Chaucer so well nowadays, because he did the same thing. He started to, you know, instead of writing in this language like Latin or French or these languages where you thought high art could come from, he used the language that people were using around town, right? And that's right. What Langston Hughes is doing too. And something else that's interesting, it's almost like a Charles Bukowski, but just better. And then I like that I've read it quite a bit just over the past week, and it's like he's complimentary of Black people, but he's also critical. which is not, you're not getting a lot of that too.
That's the big thing, is he will point out both sides of, and in one of his poems, he says, he kind of identifies that. I think I have the quote actually somewhere here, something along the lines of, we're ugly, but we're also beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Here it is. It's from the manifesto from 1926, Harlem Renaissance in the Nation. The younger Negro artists who create now intend to express our individual dark-skinned selves without fear or shame. If white people are pleased, we are glad. If they are not, it doesn't matter. We know we are beautiful and ugly too. So, I mean, I truly, he's just talking about, we're just real people. We are the same as everybody else. We have all sides to us. We're not just one thing. I think that's the big thing. He's like, he understands the, you know, he's actually sort of controversial even amongst the African-American community, because he will highlight the really ugly side of life. Mm-hmm. He actually will talk about like domestic disputes in African-American couples, which upset some of the other, you know, prominent writers at the time, because they didn't want everybody to see that. They didn't want everybody to hear that. They wanted to be represented only in a positive light. But that's not that's not him. He's honest.
Yeah. That's just as limiting as what the, you know, slaveholders were doing. Like, you're only viewing someone in a negative light is kind of equal to only viewing someone in a positive light. It's almost something inhuman. But Hughes is bringing up the complexity, and that makes you more human, more relatable, right? It's like when we read Things Fall Apart, it's like, well, this isn't just one thing. This is a very complex culture. And we learn that through a complex individual. Yeah. And that's how you see the humanity in people, through the complexity.
It's also interesting. After high school, he traveled. He went to West Africa. He went to Europe. He lived in Paris. He lived in England. And then returns to the U.S. Before that, he studied at Columbia University. But then he returns to the U.S., graduates college at Lincoln University, and that's when he kind of returns to Harlem. He's well-traveled, well-educated, just a great representative of African-American culture. And like, what better spokesperson? Mm-hmm. for a community than someone who's going to be brutally honest, but also super relatable and so educated and well-spoken, right? Just all around, just such a, you know, a great representative for this movement. Very interesting, like kind of mysterious personal life as far as like relationships go. There's a lot of questions of his sexuality, if he was asexual, if he was homosexual. No, I don't think it's really known for sure. People have been trying to decode, like, you know, if he has a secret lover that he's referring to in his poems. I think there's even a movie that shows, or, you know, him as, you know, having a secret lover. I don't think anyone knows that for sure. But no, it's very interesting. It's mysterious.
Yeah.
I think it's so funny. Like, also, why does it matter? You know, it's like,
I don't know.
He's contributed so much, and like, we want to find something to like show like a scandalous side to him.
Oh, I got totally caught up with that when I was reading about Duke Ellington.
Yeah.
Completely, like, you know, incredible composer, tons of honors, multiple honorary doctorates. But then you get tied up, go down this rabbit hole of like, wait a minute, he cheated on his wife. He did this so many times. It's like, oh, okay. All right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's just like human nature, I think. But yeah,
right.
Complicated figures for sure.
Yeah. So that's the literature part of this. I guess we should move on to the music.
We should. Yeah. Yeah, we should.
So, Greg, a few things before we get into like the specific artists. You want to talk about the clubs?
I tried to learn a lot about the clubs, but here's what I can say about the clubs. When you, the Cotton Club, for instance, and what's interesting is this will be popular for a while. And when you think about this, it's like you were talking about earlier. Think of the fur coats and the 1920s get up and the flashy, you know, dress and the almost like the big band style musicians and the horns and just this incredible atmosphere, like the drinks pouring and yeah. the swing dancing.
I
just like puts you right there, right?
I sent you this picture that I had found, and it's these two couples, two African-American couples sitting at a nightclub, and they're all dressed up to the nines. And they're like, and that's kind of in my head. That's like what I picture. Like the men were dressed in these like nice suits and the women were dressed in these like fancy dresses and stuff yeah. like that.
Have you ever seen the movie Harlem Nights?
Yeah, that's with Eddie Murphy, right?
Yeah. It's
I don't think I've ever seen it, but I always think of the cover because I know he's dressed in like, you yeah. know, he's got like the top hat, fedora, and like the suit and stuff like that. Yeah, I think it probably takes, I'm assuming it takes place in this time period.
Just like think of on the stage at, you know, this is where Duke Ellington gets his, you know, his, where he comes to prominence, right? I mean, Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday, just incredible talents. And but Langston Hughes would criticize the Cotton Club, and I read this article that he wrote about it, because eventually it starts allowing in, you know, like white patronage.
Yeah, yeah. He's not the only one. That's actually a thing. So the first club that opens, well, notable club that opens is the Savoy, which opens in 1927. It's a ballroom. It's got two bandstands that feature like continuous jazz and dancing, and that goes on past midnight, which I guess must be a big thing. And a lot of times, oh, yeah. is like battling bands and things like that. It became very fashionable to frequent like that kind of nightlife. So the businessmen in Harlem realized that some white people wanted to experience Black culture without actually having to necessarily socialize with African Americans. And that's when they started to create clubs to cater to that. It's almost like exploitation of the culture, if yeah. you think about it in a way. So you can understand why some individuals would be upset. And the Cotton Club was one of the most successful of those types of clubs, which it would, you know, like you said, it would have frequent performances by Duke Ellington and Cab Calloway. But that, yeah, that was like, it was, some people found it, like you said, they were discouraged by it, and they encouraged like people not to encourage that type of club. But then others were able to see that this was a sign that Black culture was moving towards a direction of greater acceptance.
Yeah. And it's like, are the white patrons, are they coming at it from like an anthropological like point of view, or are they just in seeing this movement and enjoying it? I'm sure it's like a mixed bag too, right?
I'm sure it's all somewhere in the middle, yeah. right?
Like Langston Hughes was like, this isn't a zoo. Like that's his point
yeah,
of view.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's like, I don't know if that's, you know, maybe for some people, sure. But I think that, and of course there's going to be pushback and there's going to be like obviously fear and animosity, but I think that it's just, people wanted to be a part of this.
Oh, it's cool.
Yeah, right? It's so cool. Yeah.
It's like, I would have wanted to be a part of that. Yeah. I would have been one of those people saying like, oh, I got to go to that club. Like that is awesome. So yeah, that's a big thing at this time. The clubs, the nightlife. That's actually when I first started reading about the Harlem Renaissance. That's immediately what caught my attention to it. I just really loved like that whole, and the prohibition's going on, right? So not mm-hmm. only is like, they're at the clubs, but they're, I'm sure there's illegal alcohol somewhere and, you know, in places, then, you know, another reason why white people are going too. They want the illegal alcohol.
For sure. But then like you have, so the response to that is a lot of the Black people would be like, all right, well, now we're going to set up these speakeasies with the secret codes and like apartment yeah. parties. And like, I mean, just this,
the apartment
New
parties,
York City,
yes.
yep. you know, New yep. York City.
The apartment parties were huge.
Elvis those, would go to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Those, so and those are so cool because they're like, yeah, it's like a club in somebody's apartment. And you just picture like anybody who's anybody being there, like all these notable like authors and Harlem, you know, all the Harlem Renaissance figures being there. And what a time this must have been.
I know,
what a time. The Harlem Stride comes out of the Harlem Renaissance, which is based off of what was earlier called ragtime. And it's ragtime, which like peaked in popularity in the 1910s for its signature trait in its ragged rhythm. But the Harlem Stride adds a wider range of piano and quick tempos with compositions written to be improvised. So it allowed like, I guess that would almost like create an atmosphere where you start having people battling and stuff like that, because they're just going improv and just going at each other. The stride refers to, I didn't know this, or I don't even know if I fully understand it. The stride actually refers to the piano player's motion of left hand striding over the piano. I don't know. Sounds cool. Yeah. I guess. James P. Johnson is the father of stride. If you guys kind of want to, you know, give a little listen to what this might sound like. But Greg, you already mentioned a bunch of, you know, the artists that came out of this, like Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Bessie Smith, Fats Waller, Cab Calloway, who I mentioned before. Those are all
Cab Calloway. Like, if you're thinking like, who's Cab Calloway? And now maybe I'm showing our age a little bit, but Blues Brothers.
Oh, like, okay. Yeah.
You know, like the end of Blues Brothers, like that's mm-hmm. Cab Calloway, like Minnie the Mooch. It's like awesome, awesome, awesome stuff. Like, we should post that clip, because that's a great little scene there. But
I'm gonna try to get some music in this episode too, like we did when we did the Robert Johnson episode. I want to get a little clip so people can kind of get a sense of what we're talking about here.
And you're talking about like this music. Direct result is like artists like Sam Cooke and Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and like you said, even Robert Johnson. I mean, it's not like sort of tail end of this is Robert Johnson.
Sure.
So I mean, this is happening everywhere. It's incredible. And you know,
I read tap dancers were popular on this time, like John Bubbles and Johnny Bubbles and Bill Bojangles Robinson.
Yeah, so, have you heard the song Bojangles?
Yeah. Yep. Isn't that Sammy Davis Jr.?
It's Sammy Davis Jr. It's also there's the Nitty Gritty Band does a great version of it. Yeah, great stuff.
Awesome. So yeah, there's so many notable names in the music. It feels like, you know, you just one of those things you just gotta go do a deep dive and you won't be disappointed. Really, really notable stuff. Some of the arts that don't really get named too much, but actors. So this time really kind of opened up opportunities for Black actors. But the reason why that's important is prior to the Harlem Renaissance, if a Black actor appeared on stage, it was going to be in the form of a minstrel show musical. Mm-hmm. And that's, they rarely ever got any serious roles in drama that are in non-stereotypical roles. So this is a big change for them, and it brings on a lot of opportunities. Paul Robeson is one of the most notable names that kept coming up whenever I was looking into this. He was an actor, singer, writer, activist. Everybody's an activist at this time. I love it.
Yeah.
They're all just really connected with art and politics. But yeah, that's a really big thing that, you know, that starts to change and obviously, you know, continues and to even go forward.
Even when all there is minstrel show, which is, you know, white actors in blackface, like singing, you know, songs, but the why those are so popular at, you know, is because they are copying the songs created by African-Americans and just put it like painting their faces black and like stealing that culture on stage. Yeah. And that's popular music.
Yeah.
Like it's literally the origin of that is literally comes from a white producer hearing a man like cleaning a horse singing a song, and he's like, I have to steal that. And he does. And crazy enough, that person, that family that he stole that song from, that family was Crow, and he names the character Jim Crow. And that's where that whole thing comes from.
Yeah, comes.
So it's like the origin of American music right there, stealing music from someone else singing it and just painting your face and making it your own. That's kind of dark.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. So where are we at now? Like,
with Paul Robeson, one of the things that he had stated was he believed that arts and culture were the best paths forward for Black Americans to overcome racism and make advances in white dominated culture, which, you know, obviously is kind of what ends up happening. Black musical revues were huge staples in Harlem. And by the mid 20s, they'd moved south all the way to Broadway, expanding into white world. So that's obviously notable. In 1929, a Black authored piece about Black lives by Wallace Thurman played Broadway. I didn't mention Wallace Thurman earlier, but he's a very notable name. I wish I had spent a little bit more time mentioning him. visual arts. There's sculptors, there's photographers. The sculptor Meta Warwick Fuller, he explored African-American themes in her work and influenced Dubois to back the Black visual arts, which was very significant. Again, kind of opening doors for them because they were often shut out of the art schools, galleries, and museums. Let's see. James Vanderzee was a photographer who captured everyday Harlem life as well as commissioned portraits in the studios. So it was all about just this idea of like, let's put ourselves in front of, you know, on the stage, be the ones we're depicting versus depicting something else for another, for the different audience, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, they're making this art for themselves and they're highlighting who they are as people. That's different.
It's like when authenticity is a part of your art, then it's as powerful as can be. And then as you lose authenticity, it kind of goes downhill. But the, you know, it, and then we kind of have, you know, and I don't know if you're here yet, but the end of the 20s is the market crash. And since this is such a new thing, like a new culture, they don't have the capital that, you know, the old money does. And art has to take a backseat to survival. And this kind of thing just peters out, right? Doesn't it? Like you said earlier, I think you literally use the term peters out, because I was like, what's that even?
Yeah.
Petering out.
So I shouldn't have used that term because it's kind of minimizes how it goes out. So a number of things happened, but like, yes, you're absolutely right. Stock market crash in 1929, The Great Depression in the early 30s. Depletes the funds that are financially supporting all the African American writers, institutions, and publications. So the money's just not there anymore. Yep. The prohibition ends in 1933. So now white patrons are not like going to the clubs to seek out the illegal alcohol because they don't have to. Major supporters like the NAACP, who we mentioned, that kind of started right before this, they're shifting their interest into economic and social issues because that's what's important at that time, or feels more important at that time. And then there's like this tension growing between the Black community and white shop owners, which really is like kind of the breaking point here. So this really comes to a head when a young shoplifter is arrested for shoplifting from a white owned store. And this ends up sparking the Harlem riot of 1935. Mm-hmm. During this riot, most of the damage is focused on property versus people. Although three are left dead and hundreds are hospitalized, but Harlem suffers millions of dollars in property damage. The worst of the destruction focuses on African American businesses and homes.
It's very Tulsa.
It's very Tulsa. So it's like this idea of this thriving area suddenly no longer thriving. It's mm-hmm. damaged. It's, you know, defunct. But aside from the actual like physical damage, the real damage is what happens to the idea of Harlem. Mm-hmm. Now it's no longer the mecca of quote unquote the new Negro. So it's everything like it was before, pretty much. It's just right. kind of misleading again.
There's another riot in 43, and then comes World War II. And then next thing you know, it's you know, the 50s, it's, you know, a lot of welfare, 60s, so all through the 90s, it's kind of like a bad neighborhood. Yeah. And, you know, it's like, you know, I'm looking at like, what's Harlem like now? And, you know, the quote that I see is, it's an up-and-coming neighborhood. And I felt like, after doing all this research, I felt kind of uncomfortable with that phrase, because it's like, what would it have been
for something, you know, to be considered up and coming that was like the most up is.
Yeah. It's such a strange way to describe it.
Yeah. It's almost like ignoring what it was.
Needs a renaissance. It does.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it can't be understated. The, like you were saying, like the art, the music, the philosophy, it really is an incredible time, a little blip in history that will, you know, have left its mark forever through the art. And you know, who was that guy that was saying that, like, about the art? Because it's so true. Because art is what sticks around. Art is truth. It's
Paul Robeson.
No, you don't remember like the riot, isn't it? The, yep. the you know, that's for the crash. All these things are forgotten. Like, they're little just headlines, but the truth is in the art and the philosophy and the theories and, you know, the sadness and the fear and the joy and all the writing. It's just, that's will last forever.
Yeah. This era really redefined how other races viewed African Americans and their whole experience, but also how they viewed themselves. They started to view themselves as worthy, mm-hmm. as individuals, as having their own individual identity. Like, there's so many factors to what this created for them. It that was like beyond powerful. That was, you know, you think about the African American community today, would it be what it is without having a movement like the Harlem Renaissance? I don't think so. It's like taking their history and saying, despite how we got here, we are here, but we are still in our own individuals. We mm-hmm. still have a history. We still have a culture. And we don't have to be afraid of our surroundings so much, because we can come together and we can build our own community. And either we're going to try to be accepted, but if we're not, we still have each other. I feel like that's kind of like a strong underlying tone there. Like, no matter what, we need to unify and have each other's back before we can expect anybody else to accept us.
Mm-hmm.
So another thing that was interesting, Greg, and I don't know if you thought about this at all. Not once did you hear about hoodoo during this whole thing. I just find that interesting because that was such a thing in the South during slavery. That was tied to their cultural roots, right? We talked about that. Like, that was something that was there to bring strength, to bring protection. It felt like it didn't have a place here because maybe it wasn't viewed as needed.
That's the thing, dude. You ask somebody, there's this great quote from, I can't remember who it is, but the question was, do you believe in God? And the quote was, only when I'm scared. Hmm. Right? So this was a time like you didn't need it. So you kind of turned your back on it. Maybe you should have kept it in the loop. Right? I mean, so, and if you're interested in hoodoo or voodoo or those other things, we do have an early episode that everyone kind of passed over, but check that out. Hmm. Guide to Hoodoo. It's a good one.
Yeah, so, Greg, I'm really interested to hear some of your final thoughts. Considering, like, when I presented this topic to you, it was met with some, like, oh, okay, you know, you think that's going to be interesting, and you know, I'm curious to hear your takeaways and your thoughts about it.
Well, as you can see, I'm wearing a giant fur coat right now. No, I honestly, like, this is, it's opened my eyes to a whole, honestly, it's got me into poetry.
Yeah.
Which is something that I'm embarrassed to say that I've never really liked that much. Mm. You know, I love, you know, Shakespeare. That's, and I like literature. That's a huge, that's what's something that connected me and you to begin with. Yeah. But poetry's always been something that, I don't know, it's sort of been out of touch for me. Like, I never really got it as much as some other people did. And some of these poems that I was reading are really deep. Like, I sent you that message about Langston Hughes and that poem about the one about the river was really deep. I mean, just the connecting, like, what the Mississippi River must have been like and what it must have meant to, you know, the people who have been working on it for generations and then moving up it. And out of it, like, what's that feel like? I mean, just you're tied to that. That's like part of your identity, that river. It's just, I don't know. It was really kind of, I don't know. There's something super powerful about poetry that I'm really kind of into it lately. And it's opened that up for me. That's the main takeaway for me. And just the idea that this is, like, I really mean it as the true renaissance. Like, if America has a renaissance, this is it. And I think it's as powerful as the European Renaissance because they were just copying where this is something novel, right? This is something new. And I think that's more powerful.
And the interesting thing about it is it can't happen without the one thing that everyone who has power is afraid of, which is knowledge, right? We always talk, well, you said it earlier, we talk about it in a lot of episodes where there's like a hierarchy of power. They never want the individuals beneath them, quote unquote, to have knowledge, to get educated, to have thought, freedom of thought, right? Mm-hmm. Look what happens when they do actually start to get the power of knowledge and the power of education. They create their own identity and they fight back. They don't just accept the social norms.
That's why you can't give knowledge. That's why they, you know, it's almost like that's known.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been known, right? What's the knowledge has been dangerous since Genesis, literally, like the tree of knowledge, right?
Yeah.
But, like Adam and Eve. So
way before Phil Collins days, you know,
way before that Genesis. Yeah. 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 No. And it's also like one more thing is the idea of suffering, not that we think it's good, but can make you better than you could have ever been before, in a sense, right? So this, right. A lot of this art comes from suffering, like generations.
Oh my God, I'm so glad you just said that. I think it's Langston Hughes. Don't hurt me if I'm wrong here. I want to say he was the one who said, if I could choose between suffering or never feeling anything, I would always choose suffering. And I forget what like the final phrase to that is. So it's kind of like a stupid thing for me to even quote, but like, it's along those same lines. Like the things you learn from suffering are the most impactful and powerful things ever. Right. Those are the things that influence you for the rest of your life.
You really, and it's not, and again, it's not like we're saying we want people to suffer, but people who have suffered, people who have been through a trauma, people who have been through a tragedy, sort of have a deeper soul, maybe a better understanding, are more empathetic, are able to, you know, think on deeper levels and more poetically sometimes. I just feel like that's the truth.
Because I mean, art is typically conveying emotion, right? If you ever look at art that is void of emotion, you probably overlook it or you disregard it or you don't like it.
Or it's crap. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you see something that has emotion, you often feel something from it. It's usually those are the ones that you feel the most connected with.
Yeah. Okay.
This was, thank you for doing this research with me, Greg. I know you actually did a lot of research throughout this week, so I really appreciate it. I appreciate you taking this topic seriously too, because it is something that, like, again, one of those topics that I'm not really sure why I'm so connected to it, but it just,
you are connected to it. Yeah.
It really does speak to me. And I've always found it very interesting. So I'm glad that you also found it interesting and you were able to take this time with me.
Of course, Dave.
We have, just kind of wrapping up, Greg, did you have any other last thoughts before we?
No, I don't. I don't.
I know this episode is definitely running a little long, but before we go, we did have another review this week that I wanted to read to the audience. This is from Molly13. I'm assuming it's Molly. 5 stars right there, Molly. You won our hearts.
Yeah.
Intriguing is a title. I like that too. We go for intriguing. Found this podcast searching up psychology to listen to while I'm at work. As a person who is interested in psychology and the psychological aspects of people, as a pre-psychology student, I like the down-to-earth perspectives and real-life aspects of topics. Thank you. I am so intrigued and look forward to listening to more episodes. Amazing.
Yeah, that we love that.
Keep that is awesome. That is very awesome. And, you know, just, we appreciate every review that is written, whether it's good, bad, anything in between, benign. We just appreciate people offering their views. And if you've reached out to us on social media, we really appreciate that too. You know, I understand you guys have other things going on in your days. So to actually sit there, take the time to write a review or to reach out on us to social media, it literally means the world to us. I think we just say that like all the time, whenever people reach out, or like, that means so much to me. And we genuinely mean that. Like,
it's really the truth. Does. We will text each other and talk about it. Yeah. So
we really do each time get very excited. And if we sound generic, I apologize, but like, that's just us being genuine and honest. Like, that is how we feel. So
we get a message from Mongolia, and that was most one of the more heartfelt ones. And it was
God, that was awesome.
Why aren't you guys more popular? And we were like, we don't know. We're trying. I don't know.
We're just two individuals living in the smallest state in the United States. So what do you expect? We're working on it, but we'll hopefully it will keep growing so that more and more audience can listen. But yeah, thank you guys all so much. And we will be back next week with a new episode. So we hope that you stay on the edge of your seat, but I really do hope you also enjoyed this, tribute to Black History Month, and maybe you learned a little something. Maybe you already knew all this and you have some light to share to us. Reach out to us, tell us, educate us, please. But until then, we will see you next week. Have a great night, everybody. Peace out.
Peace out.